Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. You are about to hear Katha Pollitt, the acclaimed poet and columnist for The Nation, discuss When the Personal Becomes Political, with John Wiener, professor of history at UC Irvine. As Barbara Ehrenreich wrote, when she finishes with a subject, there really isn't anything to say except, thanks, Katha, for clearing that up. This program was originally produced on February 19, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
We're going to swing these microphones
right into
around.
Them. Well, Katha, it's wonderful to have you here, and I have to say I love your book. It's Louise did a good job of explaining partly how what a big step it is away from your columns. Your columns, 600 words on.
A thousand words
fit on those Nation pages, you know, on the latest stupid arguments of the people we disagree with and what's wrong with them. We call this the work in this book Personal Essays, which doesn't really do justice to how rich and how varied and how insightful and how wonderful they are. I wonder if you could start with a reading of, to give our audience an example of what we're talking about tonight.
Okay, we planned this out before. I'm not picking a passage at random. After my boyfriend left me, I went a little crazy for a while. By day, I could pass for normal, as that concept is broadly understood on the Upper West Side, where I live. I sat at my desk. I took long, furious walks in Riverside Park, rehearsing all the terrible things I would say to him as he lay stricken with something rare and painful. I wandered through Zabar's looking for kitchen things to replace the ones he took when he moved out. What kind of person walks out the door after 7 years with a wooden spoon, a spatula, a whisk? For months, I would find myself in the middle of a recipe, only to discover that some basic, necessary implement was missing. But at night, after my daughter was in bed, I would settle myself at the computer with a cup of coffee. Until 1 or 2 in the morning, I would browse the internet, searching for information about him. Except browse is much too placid and leisured a word. A cow browses in a meadow. A reader browses in a library for a novel to take home for the weekend. What I did fell between zeal and monomania. I was like Javert, hunting him through the sewers of cyberspace, moving from link to link in the dark, like Spider-Man flinging himself by a filament over the shadowy chasm between one roof and another. Are you web-stalking him? A friend in her 20s asked over coffee. I hadn't known there was a word for what I was doing.
Web-stalker, it's called, and it ran in the New Yorker. Caused a sensation at the time. I remember finding it exhilarating, and I admired your courage and your honesty here. But in the aftermath of this piece appearing and then the book coming out, a lot of self-identified feminists criticized this pretty sharply. We have learned long ago that the personal is political, but they said this is too personal. This is embarrassing. This is humiliating. Katha, a leading feminist, should not be admitting to being obsessed with her ex-boyfriend leaving her. This is wrong. And I wonder what you think. What you think was going on with them, your critics, and what you think now about this move?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I wrote that piece very quickly and in a state of great exhilaration and excitement, and I sent it out to a number of friends, and it was interesting the response that came back. The people that mostly knew me just, you know, as a friend, said, oh, I'm kind of worried about you publishing this, Katha. I think maybe, you know, keep this one in the drawer. But my friends who were writers all said, oh, this is great. Send it out into the world. And they pointed out something that the people who were upset by that story didn't pick up on, which is that in a piece of autobiographical writing, the person who's telling the story is not the same as the person who is the character in the story. There's a little air in there. The person who is telling the story knows more. And thus, when I begin by saying, you know, after my boyfriend left me, I went a little crazy for a while, I thought it was completely obvious. I didn't go crazy. I just Googled him a lot. And if I had called this, I love that word, web stalker, so much, but I joke that if I had called it Googling my ex-boyfriend, nobody would have gotten all excited about it at all. But there is this side of, it was an education for me because I always thought, oh, PC, I don't even believe in that. It exists. I have to confess that. And I think one form it takes is demanding a kind of, you know, we all be wearing our Sunday best 24/7. And I didn't wear my Sunday best in this book. And some people didn't go for that.
Well, there is a familiar genre of women writing about their rotten ex-boyfriends. Women's literature, women's magazines are full of this. Your story is a little bit different.
Well, my story isn't so uplifting. I don't like those stories, which are there. There's a whole genre of books that are maybe there's some male equivalent, but I can't think what it is. Well, I guess it's like A Million Little Pieces. I mean, there's it's this recovery literature. Both men and women write that. But there is a whole big genre of women's literature that is about how I became a better person, how I improve, learned through adversity, and now I'm really good. It's often has a kind of religious element to it, and I find that very dreary. I mean, you sort of long for people who, I went through all these experiences, and yes, I learned a lot from it, but I'm still the same old ratty person I was before. So I didn't put the accent on the self-improvement, although I did learn to drive. I mean,
yes, that's where
that was a big improvement.
There is some uplift here.
That was the
book
uplift.
Is called Learning to Drive. Now, here in California, people learn to drive when they're 15 or 16. How old were you when you learned to drive?
Well, I was 52 when I got my license.
And why did this take you so long?
Well, I grew up in New York. That's been my excuse all along. You don't learn to drive when you're 15 or 16, mostly, or at least back when I was that age, you didn't. We didn't have driver's ed, and then if you don't learn them when you're young and foolish, it's much harder to learn them later when you realize a car is sort of like a sardine can, and I'm driving along in this thing, anything could happen, I'm terrified. So I took the test a couple of times, I didn't do too well, and the story talks about that. But the main reason I didn't learn to drive, and this is another, shameful feminist fact, is that there was always some guy who would drive me around when I needed to be driven around. At first I lived with a boyfriend, then I lived with my husband, and then I lived with another boyfriend, and I was like a sort of old world woman. We have to go shopping now. Let's get in the car. And it was only when the last of these chauffeur boyfriends left that I had to really grapple that, if I was going to keep my house in Connecticut, I had to really learn to do this.
Your driving instructor is a wonderful character who we meet early on in this book, and he tells you what he sees about your problem.
Yes, he says, his Ben, who was my gentle Filipino driving instructor, he was so wonderful, and he said, observation, Kata, he'd say, this is your weakness, that and lining up too far away when you go to park.
So. But now I have to interrupt here because observation is why we have all been reading you for the last 20 years. You're a very keen observer. Nothing, you don't miss anything as far as your readers are concerned. What is Ben talking about?
He meant the big picture. The big picture and checking your blind spots. These were things that, like every other person in life, you can observe 99% of what you need to observe, but it's that one little percent that you're not paying attention to. Like, what are those strange underpants doing in the laundry basket? Oh, I don't know. That simple laundry room mix-up.
So this observation, Katha, is the problem. This becomes a metaphor, but isn't there a kind of a uplift in this story, in that, as you say, you did
yes.
learn to drive?
That story is very uplifting. And if anyone here is having trouble with their driving, they should read this story, and they'll be inspired by it.
This also appeared in these are the two pieces that appeared in the New Yorker. Everything else in the book is brand new, never been seen before. Learning to Drive appeared in the New Yorker, and what kind of response did you get to that?
Oh, I got an amazing response to that. I got a ton of letters. I would say 40% of them were people wanting to tell me their stories of learning to drive and their driving instructors and how many times they took the test. And that was a little discouraging because I thought, no, it's a metaphor, really. I don't want to hear your stories. I'm the storyteller here. Then I heard from a lot of old girlfriends of the man who was the subject of the story. I got a lot of letters from people who had also had sad love stories to tell and were very, glad that I had published mine. Because that's the other side of it. You know, when people are saying, I don't want to know this thing about Katha, and those people just basically have no sense of humor. I have no sympathy for their point of view. But the other piece of it is that isn't that what writing is supposed to do? And isn't that also what feminism is supposed to do, is to bring more truth to light so that we know where we stand. And if everybody's always pretending to be something that they're not, then you put more falsehood into the world instead of more truth into the world. That can't be good.
It can't be good. So there's a couple of essays about the bad ex-boyfriend. But there's a lot of other wonderful things in the book. There's two wonderful essays about your father and your mother. You describe reading your father's FBI file after he died. What was that like?
Well, it was very interesting. My father had sent away for his file and my mother's file, but I didn't read them while they were alive because just the way my daughter doesn't read my writing, I wasn't so interested in my parents' FBI files. I wanted my own FBI file. But when I finally got to read it, it was fascinating because it was a respectable, it was like this. I don't know, that's pretty respectable.
That's good.
Isn't it? I mean, a lot of it was repeats, but... what was amazing was from what an early age the FBI was interested in my father. He always said that he had been informed on by the dean of students at his high school, at Western High School in Washington, D.C. And this, I think, was true. And not only that, by that person, he had a girlfriend named Sylvia. Sylvia's father was in the newspaper business, and Sylvia's father had a friend, just, some friend of the family. The FBI went and interviewed this friend of the father, of my father's girlfriend, my father was all of 20 at this point, who said, Basil likes to stand on a soapbox and give communist speeches. They knew what courses he took in college. They were extremely interested in all kinds. He actually had trouble, unlike today. My father had to fight to be in the army because they didn't want communists in the army. And this was World War II. He really wanted to go.
So many of the people of our parents' generation who were on the left Some of them left the Communist Party in 1956 after Hungary. Some left in 1968 after Prague. What was your father's stance, and how do you understand his party membership now?
Well, I think that a lot of those people had a great capacity to believe what they wanted to believe. I could read a little something from the book about
please,
that.
Please.
Because the Communist Party kind of fell away from my father more than the other way around. It kind of fell apart around him. He never formally left, although he moved his political interests to the Progressive Labor Party, which was a Maoist organization, I don't know. You can take the guy out of the party, but you can't take the party out of the guy. You know, he just finds another one. Okay, I'll read this part. Like a lot of lawyers in the party, my father combined uncritical devotion to the imaginary Soviet Union in his head with a passion for rights and the Constitution straight out of the ACLU charter. If you wanted to be cynical about it, you could say their commitment to civil liberties was just a self-serving tactic. But I think it was more that their minds ran on parallel tracks, and they believed what they believed while they were believing it. They were like Christians who put their faith in both miracles and surgery. One minute, my father would be dismissing the gulag with cliches like, history is written in blood, and you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. The next, he'd be expatiating on the humane wisdom of the American legal code, in which attempted murder was punished more lightly than murder, because even if it looked like your intention was exactly the same in each case, maybe your aim was that little bit off, or you didn't put in quite enough poison because your conscience deflected your hand. He could justify the forced collectivization of the kulaks between two bites of a baked potato. Not that reports of mass starvation were anything but anti-Soviet propaganda, like the Moscow show trials, so-called. And then I go on and I talk about his great, he was a wonderful lawyer, and his great sympathy for the what seemed to me as a young girl, the sad sack collection of clients that he had. But he didn't see them that way. He thought they were, you know, they were interesting human beings who deserved legal representation.
And you also read the FBI file of your mother.
Yeah. And that was very interesting, too, because from my mother's FBI file, I learned, it wasn't in there, but I deduced from it that she had had an illegal abortion.
At what point in your life did you learn this?
I learned it, it was about 5 years after she died, and I finally read her file.
And how old at this point?
Oh, I was 34, 35.
Okay. So in your mid-30s, you learned from your mother's FBI file that she had had an abortion when you were a little kid.
Yeah, well, I'll just read you the opening.
It says, please.
Okay. My mother died in 1970. This is from a story called Mrs. Razzmatazz. My mother died in 1979, but I didn't see her FBI file until 4 years later. My father requested it when he asked the Bureau for his own. What's this all about? I asked him on the phone. It says here that in November and December 1960, Mama was under the care of a physician for complications of pregnancy. I would have just turned 11. Could she have been ill for 2 months and I not remember? Oh, that was nothing, he said. But it was obvious he was lying. What do you mean nothing? I said. There must have been something to it. I'm reading it right here from the page. The FBI might have framed the Rosenbergs, but I knew they weren't making this up, whatever it was. Finally, he said in a rush, oh, all right, you really want to know? Your mother had an abortion, and she didn't tell me. Well, whose fault was that? I didn't say. When I found out afterwards, I was angry. I'll bet I didn't say. Then he said, I wonder which of her women friends was the informer. So that's the world they lived in. You just never knew.
So this was the world you grew up in, the world of McCarthyism and the world of Jewish leftists in Brooklyn. What was it like to be a kid in this world?
Well, I thought it was sort of exciting and interesting. I mean, I think all these things that sort of set you athwart the mainstream of society, and it could be radical politics, or it could be like really conservative politics, or it could be belonging to a strange religion, or in some places being Jewish, or whatever. I think that makes you have a more sort of interesting point of view on life's on society, because you are separate from it, and so you look at it in a more sort of with foreign eyes a little tiny bit. And I thought I was very communism, as I discuss in the story about my father, is a lot like Christianity in its moralism, in its that everything is really important. At any minute, you know, you could be part of some big historical event. Someone's always watching. There's nothing that's trivial. Somebody's always watching, whether it's Jesus Christ or history. So everything you do, everything you think is really important. It's like that old Puritanism where you're constantly having to sort of investigate yourself. And it's sort of, in a way, it's horrible because it does make you, I think, moralistic in a way that is hard to get over later.
But there's one
but
big
maybe you
one
never
big,
do. What, but it's also exciting.
One big difference from Christianity, at least in our day, was that in your childhood, communism was a secret.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yes, and that part of it was interesting. That my parents never said, they never told me they were in the Communist Party when I was a child, but. You kind of figure it out, but you figure it out in a way where you don't say, oh, am I right about figuring this out? And it was really only after they were dead that I felt like I could say, oh, my parents were in the Communist Party. Before that, it felt like, oh, who's going to be listening to this? You know, maybe the FBI is still here. But I remember when we would be coming home from the beach when I was little, my father would sing, you know, the wonderful songs, the Internationale and Whirlwinds of Danger and The Banks Are Made of Marble, all these, you know, great songs. But he would roll up the windows first because you just never knew who would be in a car driving by.
So I'm interested in how you see your own version of socialist feminism, left-wing feminism, in relation to your parents' politics. They were leftist. Was there any feminist or women's ideals in your growing up, or was that your own discovery? Your mother, for instance. Let's talk about your mother's politics here for a minute. The Communist Party had a position on something they called the woman question.
Yeah, what was that? I think the position was it would go away. Yeah, what was the answer? The answer was it will go away when communism comes about. They didn't really have feminism when I was growing up. But my mother, although they didn't have that vocabulary. They had more the vocabulary of a women's strike for peace, which used to meet in our living room. The idea that, you know, women should be for peace, and women were for children, and women were, you know, stalwarts of the revolution. But not that there was something going on in the family itself that was a troubling imbalance of power. That idea did come later. I mean, I'm sure you could find something in, you know, Karl Marx that talks about that, but it wasn't a live theme in left-wing politics in the 50s. But my mother had wanted to be a writer. My mother had wanted to be a journalist. She majored in journalism at the University of Wisconsin, and she went to law school, and then she married my father, and then she dropped out of law school. And she always said, I hated law school. I would have hated being a lawyer. And it is hard for me to imagine her being a lawyer because she was very kind and she was just too nice to be a lawyer. But I think that she had an idea that she very much wanted me to you know, be all that I could be, and she was very encouraging of my writing from a very early age. And she used to send me to this communist camp, Camp Woodland, for children, and she would send me She would send me poetry that she had clipped out of Vogue magazine, because although a communist, et cetera, she did read Vogue magazine. And that was how I came to love the poems of Constantine Cavafy, the great modern Greek poet, was from her.
And is there not a volume of your new poetry expected later this year?
Next year.
Well, we thank your mother for whatever role she played in that. Your book paints there's a very vivid picture of the women on your block when you were growing up, which I
recall
in this context.
Oh, here it is. Because the fact is, my mother was a very serious drinker, and that's in the story too, and that made it very painful to write. She had a life that was very complicated. People talk about feminists as being anti-motherhood, but I never would have had my daughter if it hadn't been for the women's movement. From what I saw growing up, becoming a mother was the end of being yourself. You might as well have a lobotomy and get it over with. I didn't know anyone like the mothers in the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books I loved. Women who sewed Halloween costumes and baked from scratch, and who seemed perfectly happy taking care of their big old houses, funny children, and ever so slightly dim-witted husbands. Our little street in Brooklyn was full of women who seethed with bottled-up energy and got just a little bit weirder with each passing year. Patsy's mom, chain-smoking in her doorway, watching the comings and goings of her neighbors with her witchy black eyes, was weird. You had to pretend to be in a big hurry when you walked by, or she'd try to involve you in some long, urgent, off-key conversation. And so was Janet's mom, pacing her beautiful brownstone like a panther, turning out the occasional wild, huge oil painting in between the children, the husband, the three meals a day. Annie's mom wasn't weird. She just drank a lot. But then there was no Annie's dad to explain that the reason Annie's mom got mad for no reason was that she was about to get her period. So that was the 50s. People remember it as a much happier time than in my experience it was.
It certainly makes Betty Friedan, the feminine mystique, seem completely appropriate.
Well, you see where that book came from.
Yeah. So this brings me back to the learning to drive observation, Katha. Observation, your driving instructor says, and you did not observe that your mother was an alcoholic.
No, I did not. And I think, you know, much as I hate to use the language of recovery and all that, I think denial is a real thing. You can see something and not see it because you love the person and you don't want to think ill of them. And if you live with someone every day, it's really remarkable how little you can notice. You notice much more if you see somebody once a year, because then you notice all their changes. But if you live with somebody, you don't notice a lot. That's a deep and painful truth of marriage, I think. So, I didn't. And not only that, but having been told about my mother's problem, I then kind of managed to persuade myself that she was fine, even though, I mean, she was pretending to be fine. So that's the other side, that in both of those cases, if a person sets out to deceive you, they can do it a lot of the time because, you know, you're going along with life, you're seeing what you want to see. That's the way it is.
That passage that you read to us started out with you saying that, talking about your own becoming a mother. You have a daughter who's how old?
She's 20.
And what is the relationship between your being your mother's daughter and being the mother of your own daughter? Because the sort of feminine mystique picture you give us might lead us to think you would want to avoid the fate of the women on your block growing up.
Yes.
In your own life.
Yes, you would think that. But as I, there's a story in there called Beautiful Screamer, which is about when my daughter was a baby. And I say that in exactly the way that you prepare for yourself the bed you most don't want to lie in, I had become the thing I most didn't want to be, which was a stay-at-home wife and mother. It was just amazing. And, you know, part of it is you just don't see these things coming, and another part of it is the way that It's really hard after you have a baby to keep going with your own work. I think that's a time when, for a lot of women, I mean, of course, a lot of women have to get right back to work, but if you have the fortune, I won't say good or bad fortune, but just the fortune to be a writer and work from home, gosh, a lot of time can go by before you, you know, look at that typewriter. And that was, it wasn't a very fruitful time for me.
Now, 20 years ago, you were already a prominent feminist voice. Was having a child consistent with your feminist ideas, or was this a step in another direction?
Well, no, I think it's, I think it's very feminist to have a child if you want to have a child.
Because, of course, the cliche is that the women's movement turned people away from motherhood.
I think it's just the opposite. I think that life, organized the way it is, makes it hard for women to have children and combine that with other things. Although, to the great credit of women, most of them managed to, keep going. But I, as I said, I think that it was feminism that made motherhood, it transformed motherhood. I mean, if you go back, you see that the expectation was of hostility between mothers and daughters. And that, I think, was because, this is pre-feminist, because of the role that mothers played in cutting their daughters down to size. The mothers would be saying, if you don't act too smart with boys, lose gracefully at games, pretend to be stupid, learn how to be a good listener, maybe you should be a nurse or a teacher and not a doctor or a professor, et cetera, et cetera. And feminism transformed that so that instead of being the prison guard, the mother would be the encourager, the person helping their daughter into a wider life. And I think that among people I know, they have much better relations with their children than our generation did. I'll just give you one example. Everyone I know who's my age, when we went to college, we didn't go back. I wasn't calling my parents all the time. My daughter calls me practically every day. I never asked my parents, well, what should I study, and what do you think I should write about for my English paper, and, it was a real, there was a real separation there, and I think that mothers and daughters are closer now.
I think you are right, and yet you say that you became a stay-at-home mom, which wasn't the idea that you had about motherhood. How did that happen?
Well, it's because, as I talk about becoming a gender Republican, that if you don't really have a very strong plan against the social norm, and I think many people don't, many couples don't when they have children. They just assume everything's going to go on the way it was before, but it isn't going to be like that. Then the old patterns reassert themselves because, and they seem like nature. That's the thing that's so amazing, that instead of seeming like something you're doing now, it seems like it was always going to be this way, that like who has the health insurance? That turns out to matter. Who is the freelance arty person, and who has the, who's working for the man? That turns out to matter too. Who feels guiltier? Who just, I say, is not going to be deflected from their life path no matter what? That who's more willing to make the other person unhappy? All those things. All those things play a big role. And I don't know, I hear, that young people now, it's a little different. I don't know. I think it's always, people are always saying, oh yeah, young people, it's really different. But then it turns out it's not so different. I would say my husband and I became a much more conventional people than we ever thought we would have. So I had to divorce him.
Moving right along, So we talked about the relationship between your parents' politics and yours. You also, in this book, write a little bit about your daughter's politics and her relationship to feminism. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I said before, your children don't read what you write. I don't know a single writer whose son or daughter sits down and reads what they write. But I did show
David Reif, don't you think?
No, I think David Reif is David Reif is the big exception to this rule.
The exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. But I did show Sophie, I gave her the opportunity to read some of this, the first two stories, and I could just see that she wasn't reading it. She was turning the pages like this, you know, just to sort of be polite, you know. She had no interest. So I didn't show her the rest of the book because I figured she wasn't interested, and I did hear later that, you know, she hadn't been too happy with some of the things I wrote, and maybe this was the thing, because I did write about how... And maybe Obama's going to change all this. Maybe this is the change that he thinks. But that there's, I just do feel that my daughter's generation have very good instincts. They're very good people, but they don't have the sense that they can make a real difference politically, in maybe in other ways. And they're very altruistic, and they're always, you know, they do a lot of volunteering and all that, but the political thing, for example, if you compare anti-war activism back in the day and now, there's nothing going on campus, even though the nation's always running these pieces claiming that there is. There, in fact, is not. That is propaganda. And I asked... I had a bunch of Sophie's friends over for dinner, and I asked them about this, and I asked them, why do you think that is, that the campuses are so quiet? And one of Sophie's friends said, because we saw that you did it and it didn't work. Ooh. Ooh. I know. Ooh. Ouch. I really felt terrible. Yeah, I know. I didn't really... What he says, but it did, you know?
I hope you leapt to your feet and defended your honor here. No, but you also write about what the form that let's call it the legacy of feminism has taken in your daughter's generation, the kind of you-go-girl sense that they have.
Yeah, I think that they... I mean, is there a passage that you wanted me to read about that?
Well,
I mean,
there's that wonderful thing about Facebook that I just love.
Oh, where do I write about Facebook?
Maybe you could...
I don't know where that is. I was horrified by Facebook, though. Oh. Even though I'm now on it, and what a mistake. I'm on an email list of women journalists, and at a certain point we decided we'd all go on Facebook and then we could, I don't know, do whatever people do there. So now all these people want to be my friend who I've never heard of and
ignore.
And then they send me, they tell me what they're doing. I think they're friends with other people I've never heard of. And if you join these little groups, you know, I'm now in the Mississippi Coalition for Reproductive Rights, and so I find out about all their cocktail parties. I'm thinking, I don't want to know about this. But anyway, I did spend this before I myself was on Facebook, and back when you had to be have a college affiliation to be in it, I did spend an evening with a friend. I got in on her EDU address. And it was really interesting because the pictures of the girls and the pictures of the boys were they came out of different worlds. The girls all, I have to say, looked like, you know, very slutty. They looked like they were going out on a very slutty date. They were in their little black dresses and made up, lots of makeup and, you know, you didn't see their little stiletto heels, but you intuited them from the rest of the picture. And just falling out of their bras. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but the boys they looked like these drunken schlubs. It was weird. Their pants are falling down, and their They have these sort of stupid expressions on. They're holding up these beer cans. And I did think, like, how are these people going to get together, you know? This sort of postmodern, you know, you go girl, sex radical feminist, and the drunken guy, you know? And yet they do. They have no choice, but those are the only choices there are each, unless they're gay. Then they have other problems. But it was quite interesting, sort of what each side felt they should be presenting to the world. And I just can't get over that.
So the present mode of that you call "you go girl." What's your assessment of this? There is this sense that now women can do anything. It's okay to be sexy. It's you have some reservations about this.
Well,
and it's not about the sex part.
No, it's not about that at all. But I think that there's always this tension in feminism between being very being rather dictatorial about personal life. Say the personal. If you say the personal is the political, that's a real slippery slope that I found myself on, as a matter, without even knowing it. Because then, what is not available to be scrutinized and judged by other people, and you can't live like that. Life is too big and too complicated, and people are too strange and weird to live like that for a long time. But the moving away from that, you can get into sort of like, well, anything you want is feminism. So if anything you want is feminism,
And this is because you can choose it. You are free to choose.
You are free to choose. And so you are free to choose objectifying yourself in a very degrading way. You're free to choose not developing your inner life. You're free to choose, you know, taking your husband's name, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with that is that all these choices are presented as if they're just a menu that you picked up in a restaurant, rather than choices that are constructed, that are socially constructed and presented to you with pluses and minuses and consequences. I wish I had a nickel for every piece I've read in which a young woman is writing and saying, well, I'm going to change my name and I'm getting married and it's really great and I think that's the feminist thing to do and my friends don't like this, blah, blah, blah. And I just think, well, you know, it's actually not the feminist thing to do. I mean, you can do it. We all do things that aren't feminist, but it isn't the feminist thing to do. And what you're not talking about is what happens if you do the other thing? You know, that's the thing. It's like, what happens if you don't dress in a fashionable way? What happens if you don't have plastic surgery? That sort of little bit of social coercion that's often in there but concealed under many layers of, you know, blather and nonsense is the thing that doesn't get talked about. I mean, would your husband actually be happy if you said, well, Joe, I've decided I really love my own name. You can take my name. Would he say, oh, that's great. I've never cared about my name. And, you know, I've never liked my name. You know, and not like changing your name or not changing your name is the world's biggest issue either. But it is a little issue that has that is about where identity is going to be, and who, you know, why can't they both change their names if they don't like their names? So anyway, I discussed this at some briefly.
Well, our time is flying here. Since we are in the library and this is a book crowd, I wanted to spend a little time talking to you about your time when you were working in the publishing business.
Yes, well, there's a story in here. It's called Memoir of a Shy Pornographer. And it's about, this is what happens if you don't like have a good post-college plan.
Kids pay attention
yeah, kids
to this
pay
part.
Attention. Right. I ended up proofreading and copy editing pornographic novels for a a company called Beeline Books. And so there's a piece in there about that. And you know, it's funny because everybody talks about the death of the book, and there's actually a whole sort of elegy in another story called End Of, where I give a whole list of things I like that there's less and less of in books is in there. But pornographic novels, when was the last time you know, it's all visual now. It's just like every other kind of literature. People are just too lazy to read. They want it all on the screen. So those books have a certain antiquarian interest now.
So what was it like being a copy editor for pornographic fiction?
Well, it was a very interesting experience. I mean, it drives you kind of wild because these books were so terrible. They were just dreadful. And the way they were constructed, this place, Beeline, actually had rules. Every book had to have characters, a plot. It had to have a location. And not all books are like that, but they had this kind of, you know, you'd have your little bit of plot, character, and location, and then the sex scene, which would be like 30 pages. I mean, my God, you know, it's like, how can you, 30 pages is a lot of writing. You could probably describe all of World War II in 30 pages and not leave too much out. And so you would come across these things, these wadges, these dense wadges of excruciatingly tedious and yet curiously arousing also descriptions. And you'd have to be proofreading, and I'd say, oh, right, okay, it's not aureole, it's areola, it's not between, it's among. You're fixing the spelling. It was sort of wild. It was kind of wild. And I did, you know, it does, you do learn things. It was educational.
It's just so mind-boggling that you were enforcing these literary standards on this degraded genre.
Somebody has to keep these standards up. It does not have an apostrophe.
I'm almost ready to give up on that one. My department chair sent out an email with the apostrophe and the wrong it's. It's like, I give up. So what led you to, how long did you work at Beeline, and how did you,
well, I just did
where
it
did
from,
this fit into your career as a writer?
Well, I've always thought it would be fun to write one, but I think that dense wadges of sexual description would defeat me. Maybe I could just borrow them from another book. I think they did a lot of that. I think there was a lot of borrowing and plagiarizing. I did it for a couple of years, sort of on and off. It wasn't something I did as a full-time job. It was just something to, you know, make a little extra money on the side.
We have just a couple of minutes before we turn to questions, and I want to talk about one of your essays that meant a lot to me, and that was the one about the Marxist study group.
Oh, yes. Well, I was in a Marxist study group, which I had to join as everybody else is fleeing Marxism. I'm thinking, oh, this sounds interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Let me just say, most of us were in Marxist study groups sort of in the 70s. When did you join one?
I joined it in the 90s. I'll just read the opening of that story, which is called In the Study Group. Okay. Toward the end of the 1990s, long after most people I knew had put their German ideology and their 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon on the top shelf of the bookcase with the Norton Anthology and six Greek plays, I joined a Marxist study group. This was something I had avoided throughout my 20s and 30s, when Marxism still had some life in it, before it migrated from political economy, the actual subject of Marx's inquiries, to criticism of art and literature, topics about which he had remarkably little to say, and where he joined Freud, another big thinker booted out of his original field. The two of them were like heads of bankrupt corporations who had donned blue jeans with elasticized waists and were enjoying a leisurely retirement as film buffs and book clubbers and explorers of trendy new neighborhoods. It was pathetic, really, when you thought about it, the way Marx, that bushy-bearded, carbuncle-tormented Victorian who had laid bare the secret workings of all human history and caused the foundations of the world to quake, had become just another instant analyst of everything from Hamlet to Batman. Now that Marxism was over, it had a thrift store charm. You could feel a melancholy curiosity about it, the way you could wonder about a Harris tweed suit still sporting its Scottish label that had wound up as the Salvation at the Salvation Army store.
I think it's time to turn to the audience for questions. If anyone has a question, now's your chance to. We have microphones, so let us wait until the microphone is put in your hand and speak into the microphone. Thank you.
Katha, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Do you feel that we feminists lost control of the conversation in terms of what you were describing about the young women and taking their husbands' names and the way they dress? I myself am extremely concerned that somewhere male market forces took over the conversation and sold to young women the sex and the citification of the world, the girls gone wild of the world, where promiscuity became the definition of empowerment. If you were empowered, you were free to be a slut and encouraged to be a slut because it was so pleasing to those drunken boys down in Florida and elsewhere in the world. And I don't know how to take back the conversation except, you know, in our own homes.
Well, you know, I've had that thought too, and yet, just to complicate it a little bit, The Zipless Fuck was a novel, in a novel by Erica Jong a long time ago. And when I remember, we forget our own youth. I remember when I was about 30, I took out, like I decided to clean out my closets, and I found like all these clothes that I had worn in college and shortly thereafter. And these little dresses were like shirts. I couldn't imagine putting them on. So, I mean, I think a lot of women in this room went through a kind of a wild time in their life that didn't have the stamp of, I'm doing this for feminism, but they were doing it. And, you know, I would just wear like my brown turtleneck for, you know, a month at a time. And sometimes I went around in clothes that would rival anything that people are wearing now, I'm proud to say. Lots of makeup, I dyed my hair, of course I've kept doing that for the rest of my life. I've never stopped doing that. I don't even remember what color my hair is. I know what you mean, but I think, you know, that sexuality is a really strong and powerful force, and people, when they are young, they want attention for that, and they want, I mean, I came across this quote from Thomas Malthus the other day, and he said, well, that there were two things that he couldn't see. No matter what happens in human history, they will always be the same. And he said, and one of them is the power of the passions, by which he meant the sex drive. He was just putting it in a nice, romantic 19th century way. I forget what the other one was, but you know, it's very, very strong. And I think that's a lot of what's going on. But then there's also that wanting approval, that not having the other piece of it. And I think, that obviously some of those girls gone wild are manipulated because they're really drunk when they do that. And that's not good. And that's why Joe Francis, you know, should get in a lot of trouble, the man who's in charge of Girls Gone Wild. How to take back the conversation, I think it's almost at the point where those young women have to have that conversation themselves. I don't think that someone my age can have their direct their conversation. And there are like these really, there is young feminism on blog, for example, in the blogosphere. There's a website I really like called feministing.com, and there are a whole bunch of feminist blogs. And I think that sort of, they have to do it in their language and with their cultural references. And I feel I'm very out of it, and I'm happy to be out of it.
That everyone wants to work, and I wonder how honest that is, and I admire your honesty in admitting those parts of ourselves that might seem old-fashioned.
Most women have to work, and most women do work. I think that whole... that whole stay home go to work conversation is happening in a very, you know, the so-called mommy words, is happening in a very small part of the culture. But it is the part of the culture that is the demographic that upscale publications aim at. So that's, to them, the New York Times has run so many articles. I mean, every time a woman quits her job, they put her on the front page, you know. And I find myself wondering now, the New York Times is full of women, working women. So, you know, they have a lot of women editors, they have a lot of women writers. They're not staying home. So where do they get, you know, where are they coming, you know, and then they have all this, you know, all the men too. So where are they coming from? But I think that they are coming from the little sliver of the culture where they can feel that tension because they could leave and they don't want to, and but then they feel like, you know, they have that whole thing. Then the other place I think you feel it is in the working class where life is so stressful because there's so little social support for families. So if you have both parents and they're each working two jobs, and you have these families that you know, the husband and wife basically are on, you know, different shifts at home, and they hardly ever see each other. And so you could see from that point of view the idea that wouldn't it be nice if, you know, the kids could get some parenting in here, would be very appealing. But the thing that never gets talked about is the way that, you know, we could have a social system in which everybody didn't have to work quite so hard, in which there were supports for families and children, and like they have in, you know, modern Europe, in, you know, Western Europe, that would be nice. And we don't seem to be able to kind of put the, you know, the money into those structures. I know there's somebody back there.
Somebody way in the back.
I'm really curious about your ex-boyfriend's reaction to you web-stalking him. Did you hear what it was? And are you sorry that you did it?
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you say that, because I thought web-stalking was a joke, I mean, that word, because web-stalking is not stalking. Stalking is when you you stand outside and you follow them and you break into their apartment and, you know, you call them up 50 times a day and things like that. Looking up things about someone on Google is sort of like research. It's more research than stalking. So he had no idea that I was doing this. How would he know? You don't know when somebody's Googling you.
Then your article appeared in The New Yorker and
well,
was the talk
true.
Of the town.
Oh, right. I keep forgetting that. Right. But that's different. That was writing. I have no idea what he thought about it because he didn't. Because I haven't seen him or spoken to him since we broke up. If I were him, I would be happy to have been the muse of an interesting piece of writing. Excuse me. Sure. Yeah. Right there.
Well, this isn't a question as much as a thank you to you, because I know you through Nation magazine. I don't know your books. When you recommend different organizations which need support, and I'm delighted to be able to thank you for one of your suggestions, that group in Germany which sponsors the Bosnian children to go for the week, the holiday. I've been supporting it many years, and it's
oh, that's so great!
Yeah.
And they send you those thank you notes too.
Yes, they do.
Well, John is a godparent too every year. This is the Bosnian Initiative Frankfurt, which is a German human rights organization that has a camp for. It started out with for Bosnian kids to get them out of their horrible war torn situations, and now they do a lot with bringing Palestinian and Israeli kids together outside. The Middle East, in order to have fruitful discussions about, you know, the Middle East, which they can't have there. So thank you so much for Well, I just pass the checks along, so it's you who writes them.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I think that upscale demographics explain why we always hear this, that young people aren't involved in the anti-war effort. I think that it's become such a class and economics issue. And I think that the college kids that are involved in the anti-war effort are through outside groups, not on the campus, because there's no draft. But I think young people are, you know, it's just not on college campus. But I heard you say in an interview within the past year something, a comment that I really liked, that there seems to be more of what you don't like. Do you remember that comment?
Yes.
Is that in that book by chance, or could you repeat that?
I said there's more and more of that in the world. I find more and more of the things I don't like and less of the things I do like. And it's true, like classical music. I think in 20 years, will there be classical music? You think so?
Sure.
Well, I mean, right now it's like 1% of records that are sold. It's a struggle. Books, you know, figures on books aren't too encouraging. Nature, of course, less and less nature. Polar bears, you know, the usual, snail darters. I felt this way. I was walking around downtown Los Angeles, and I decided I'd go to the museum, and then that was closed, and so I decided I would walk to Chinatown, and I found myself, it was like being in a science fiction movie, having to cross enormous freeways and getting this sort of feeling of disorientation, feeling like... how did this city become, and it's not the only city like this, I mean, wonderful city and all like that, I don't mean to say mean things, but, you know, great big tall buildings, big freeways. If you're a pedestrian, you really kind of, you know, you're like a little fly without wings. And how did that happen? I mean, a city used to be the place where, you know, a very collective social life went on. And now a city is a place that makes that very hard to have.
Do you have two more questions?
Okay.
Well, I have a question, but I'd just like to make a comment first about why there doesn't appear to be more activity about the war. When in Berkeley, when we would demonstrate, you'd go home and watch it on TV. With five corporations dictating the media, they just don't cover it. So if the tree falls in the forest, nobody hears it, it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
My question has to do with the fact that I was raised in a traditional Jewish family, which was a matriarchal society, and for me, the feminist movement was not a big thing because I always knew my mother wore the pants. She was the boss. And what I became more and more disillusioned with and disappointed with is that I watched the way women process, and it was something much superior to the way men did until they got into power. And then in my law school, I found that the women were trying to become more like the worst aspects of the men to kind of say, you know, I can be one of you guys, instead of bringing in what it was that I found to be the strongest thing in the feminist movement, which was just being a woman and the way women approach problems. Kind of like the switch between the goddess to the god. You know, coming from a society that worshiped the earth and doesn't trash the earth to one that is patriarchal and violent and destructive. I was wondering if you had any comments about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you say about the Jewish family, because so many of the important voices in feminism, in the what they call the second wave of feminism in the 60s and 70s, were Jews. Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug, Betty Friedan, on and on and on. I mean, way disproportionate to their numbers in the population. So that Jewish family couldn't have been all that matriarchal if so many of the women in it felt they had to, you know, become feminists. About your second point, maybe the kind of matriarchy that it was wasn't ultimately satisfying enough. About the other thing, you know, I think it's a... we've seen with, I don't know, people are in a social structure that values certain things. As they move into that social structure, it's not like you can change, you can't, just having different people cannot transform it, because it's still the same. Money must be made, law, people must be sent to prison, you know, whatever it is. So I think you can't blame women that they did not transform capitalism, because I don't think that can be done in that way. The other thing is that, I mean, I think we're seeing now with the campaign of Hillary Clinton, and I am, you know, on record as supporting Obama, but one thing I do feel very strongly, and I have written about 9,000 pieces about this, is how unbelievably sexist the attacks on her have been. And there are things that in a man would just not be noticed at all, or would be not subject to any kind of judgment, for example, the color of her shirt, or you know, certainly her marriage has been, you know. Okay, but you know, it wasn't that he wore the earth tones. It was that Naomi Wolf, a woman, told him to wear the earth tones, and that made him seem pussy whipped. That was what that was all about. If he'd just worn the earth tones, that would have been fine. So that actually is an argument from my side. just in case you missed that. We really are not happy, I think, as a culture with the picture of the powerful woman. That it's, I wrote this piece where I Googled Hillary Clinton, and then I put all these sexist things like Ice Queen, Lady Macbeth, bitch, slut. Hundreds of thousands of hits come up. It's really unbelievable. And all these talk show hosts on the radio and on TV, like Chris Matthews, who had to apologize for one thing he said, but he said about 50 other things. For example, she's like Madame Defarge. How is Hillary Clinton like Madame Defarge? Is she knitting people's names into her endless scarf so that then they will be guillotined? I mean... Is she leading a revolution? I don't think so. I think that the expectation that women can, you know, be sort of these morally perfect, wonderful, angelic creatures who will transform our evil society is probably a hope that can never be realized. Because they're just people, after all.
Do we have time for one more? One more. You pick.
Back there. Yeah.
Hi. I wanted to make a point that we, all of us here, have the luxury of talking about how the personal is political and focusing on the small details of our lives, and how lucky for us that we can do this. But around the world, most women, it's the political that becomes personal, because the governments in the countries where they live institutionalize patriarchal rules and keep them so submissive that they can't even walk out of their homes without covering themselves from head to toe. They can't drive, they can't go to school. Abuse and oppression of women is institutionalized into their cultures. They don't have the luxury of sitting around like we do and, talking about all of these things. And I was hoping that you could perhaps make some comments about how feminism has or has not made a difference in the world and really in women's lives around the world.
I think feminism has made a tremendous difference. Even in countries that are very patriarchal, you will find a feminist movement, an indigenous feminist movement, full of very interesting, strong, and radical women who I think in some ways put the American feminist movement to shame. I don't buy this, you know, oh, they're so submissive thing. I mean, if somebody says, if you don't wear a burqa, we're going to put you in jail, we'd all be in burqas. In Africa, in India, in Pakistan, in the Muslim world, there are very, very strong women, and they are making a lot of progress. I mean, always, you know, against you know, forces arrayed against them. But I think that feminism is a world transformative movement that is only in its very, very early stages. And I don't, you know, it's like there's this feminism is dead meme that is constantly being promoted in the American press. You know, which started out in like 1969. Oh, women aren't so interested in feminism anymore. It had only been feminism for like 5 minutes. And they're already tired of it. But this is not true at all, because as long as there is the kind of suppression of equality and fairness and social justice that characterizes, I think, every country, I wouldn't limit it to, you know, just the third world or the developing world at all, but here too. I mean, I think women are still very unfairly subject to unequal laws and unequal, not even laws as much as unequal social customs and expectations. You're going to have feminism because this is the modern world, and we're not living in the Middle Ages, where by the time you look around and see what's what, you're dead. People now, I think, have enough so that they can really, they can really demand their rights. And women are doing that all over the world, and it's really great. So on that note, thank you all for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.